Peace Los Angeles, the Institute for Policy Studies, and KPFK. More information available at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Lisa Gay Hamilton, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, the voice of mass dissent in Southern California. It's Monday, March 23rd. Democrats celebrate the 21st anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. As President Donald Trump says the U.S. is in talks to end the U.S. Israeli war on Iran, but Iran calls that fake news.
They're spending $2 billion a day on a foreign war while they cut nearly $1 trillion from Medicaid. It's the largest cuts to our social services in the history of this country.
The U.S. Supreme Court considers a challenge to include mail-in ballots that come in after Election Day, a challenge backed by President Trump to limit voting access, a decision that could impact rural voters and soldiers overseas, among others. It's expected before the midterms, with GOP control of the House on the line. As the government shutdown drags on, President Trump deploys ICE agents to airports as more TSA workers labor without pay and quit. ICE agents at San Francisco International Airport make a violent arrest just days before the announcement.
The woman who was brutalized last night and put on a plane, as I understand it, with her young child, but it is just part of a broader pattern of what they're doing to families.
And the California governor's race is heating up, with Democratic candidates of color accusing ABC and the University of Southern California of excluding them from a statewide televised debate scheduled for tomorrow.
This process is rigged.
News on these stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. It's day 24 of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. President Donald Trump today wrote on social media that conversations over the last 2 days have been productive, and he's postponing military strikes on Iran's power plants and energy infrastructure for a five-day period.
They called. I didn't call. They called. They want to make a deal.
He reiterated that while in Tennessee today.
The woman who was brutalized.
We have a very serious chance of making a deal. That doesn't guarantee anything. I'm not guaranteeing anything. I'm not going to come out here in a week or 2 weeks and have you all say, oh, you said, I didn't say anything. All I'm saying is we are in the throes of a real possibility of making a deal.
And he also warned against a no deal.
A top person. Don't forget, we've wiped out the leadership phase one, phase two, and largely phase three, but we're dealing with the man who I believe is the most respected and the leader.
Mr. President, I know you've deployed.
Because I don't want him to be killed.
In response to strikes on and threats of more strikes on their energy infrastructure, Iranians have formed human chains around major power plants across the country. Residents in Avaz near the Iraqi border gathered around the Ramin power plant, while crowds in Mashhad near Afghanistan assembled outside a power plant in what participants described as a show of support for critical infrastructure and defiance of threats, according to DropSite News, citing reporting from Fars Media. Christopher Martinez has more.
President Donald Trump has extended his deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, saying now he will temporarily hold off on strikes. He spoke at a safety task force meeting in Memphis.
As I announced earlier, based on preliminary conversations between the United States and Iran over the past 2 days, I've directed the Department of War to temporarily postpone planned strikes against major energy and electricity targets in Iran.
He says the U.S. and Iran are having good discussions that could lead to a deal to end the fighting.
And so we're giving it 5 days, and then we're going to see where that takes us. And I would say at the end of this period, I think it could very well end up being a very good deal for everybody, as good as if we went all the way and just literally annihilated the place, which if we don't have to do that, that would be a good thing, not a bad thing.
Trump's announcement was welcomed by British Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
Well, my very strong view is we need to de-escalate and bring an end to this conflict as swiftly as possible. And we've been working with a number of countries in that regard. And to that end, I welcome the talks reported between the US and Iran. And to be clear with the committee, we, the UK, were aware that was happening. And the immediate priority has to be a swift resolution of the conflict.
Talks between the U.S. and Iran would be good news, but Iran is throwing water on the claim. Two Iranian news agencies close to Iran's Revolutionary Guard say there have been no negotiations with Washington. An Iranian parliament speaker wrote a message on social media saying fake news is used to manipulate the financial and oil markets. And indeed, oil prices did drop after Trump's announcement. Speaking to reporters in Florida, Trump said the U.S. is negotiating with an unnamed Iranian official.
But we're dealing with some people that I find to be very reasonable, very solid. The people within know who they are. They're very respected. And maybe one of them will be exactly what we're looking for. Look at Venezuela, how well that's working out.
Trump says Iran badly wants to make a deal, and Trump has long boasted of being a deal maker, just as he boasts of being a peace president.
No, we have a very serious chance of making a deal. That doesn't guarantee anything. I'm not guaranteeing anything. I'm not going to come out here in a week or 2 weeks and have you all say, oh, you said, I didn't say anything. All I'm saying is we are in the throes of a real possibility of making a deal, and I think if I were a betting man, I'd bet for it. But again, I'm not guaranteeing anything.
Trump is suggesting that the talks could lead to the U.S. taking over Iran's enriched uranium. And of course, the opening of the Strait of Hormuz is key. A reporter asked Trump who will be in charge of the strait.
Maybe me. Maybe me. Me and the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is, whoever the next Ayatollah. Look, and there'll also be a form of a very serious form of a regime change.
Talks or no talks, deal or no deal, the war continues. The United Nations is warning about the effects of the war on the global economy, with the Strait of Hormuz in the crosshairs of a geopolitical conflict that has shut a key path for the flow of oil and other commercial shipping. Frida Yosef is with the UN Conference on Trade and Development.
It's affecting transport, it's affecting energy, it's affecting food, and also cost and availability of all these. So these all together would have an impact on the public finance of countries as well as on cost of living.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The head of the International Energy Agency says the global economy faces a major, major threat because of the Iran war. Fatih Birol told Australia's National Press Club today the crisis in the Middle East has had a worse impact on oil than the two oil shocks of the 1970s combined, and a worse effect on gas markets than the Russia-Ukraine war. Israel launched a new wave of attacks today against Tehran, and Iran renewed strikes on its Gulf neighbors, threatened to start hitting their power plants. The death toll has risen to more than 1,500 Iranians, more than 1,000 in Lebanon, 15 in Israel, and 13 U.S. military members, as well as the number of civilians on land and sea in the Gulf region. Millions of Lebanese and Iranians have been displaced. Saudi Arabia's defense ministry said late today, Pacific Standard Time, it destroyed at least 19 drones in the kingdom's eastern province. Kuwait's energy ministry said 7 high-voltage power lines were damaged by shrapnel from air defense operations, causing partial outages in several areas. In Iraq, a commander in the Popular Mobilization Forces was killed along with several others in an airstrike that targeted its command headquarters in the western province of Anbar, according to the Shia group. The PMF, which is formally placed under the control of Iraq's military, in practice still operates with significant autonomy. It accused the U.S. of carrying out the strike. The PMF allied with Iran. Meanwhile, Israel's military carried out overnight strikes on multiple neighborhoods in Lebanon and Beirut's southern suburbs, saying it was targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. No injuries were immediately reported. Low-flying jets were heard over the city as the strikes took place. The military had earlier in the day renewed evacuation warnings for several neighborhoods as tens of thousands of residents had already fled the area. Large fires and plumes of smoke were seen rising across the southern suburbs following the strikes. Israeli strikes have so far killed more than 1,000 people in Lebanon and displaced about 1 million others, according to Lebanese authorities. Meanwhile, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations is making the case that military cooperation between Russia and Iran, including on drones, constitutes a, quote, enormous threat to international security, unquote, during the war in the Middle East. Andrea Melnik told the UN Security Council today that Russia's providing intelligence support, including satellite imagery and other data, to help Iran target U.S. military assets in the region. A claim echoed by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who spoke today giving his evening address, warning that there's growing evidence Russia's providing intelligence support to Iran.
Є більше підтверджень, що росіяни продовжують надавати іранському режиму допомогу.
Speaking in his nightly address, Zelensky said Moscow was trying to help the Iranian regime stay afloat and prolong the conflict with the U.S. and Israel. He said Kiev had intelligence Russia may be preparing for a massive strike on Ukraine soon as well. He said there's, quote, growing evidence Russians continue to provide the Iranian regime with intelligence support. Clearly destructive activity, and it must be stopped as it only leads to further destabilization. All decent states are interested in guaranteeing security and preventing a larger crisis. Markets are already negative, and this is a significant complication to fuel in many nations. Helping the Iranian regime stay afloat and strike more accurately, the Russians are effectively prolonging the war. There must be a response, Zelensky said. Residents today in the West Bank reacted after 10 Palestinians were injured in attacks by Israeli settlers who rampaged through nearby villages after holding a funeral for a settler killed in a car crash. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said the wounded in Deir al-Hattab included a 45-year-old man shot in the foot and a woman suffering from smoke inhalation. Videos show cars and homes set ablaze as army flares lit up the sky near the village east of Nablus and next to the Israeli settlement of Elam Moreh. Human rights activists, the Red Crescent, and authorities have denounced what they say is the delay of emergency services at Israeli checkpoints in the West Bank. The arson and the assaults in 4 Nablus area villages Sunday came a day after the official Palestinian news agency WAFA reported simultaneous attacks in at least 6 communities overnight, the latest spates of violence in the occupied West Bank. It came after mourners held a funeral for an 18-year-old Israeli settler. Authorities said he was killed in a collision with a Palestinian vehicle in an area north of the villages attacked. Police said they were investigating the settler's claims that the collision was deliberate. Israel's military did not respond to questions about the attack. The violence came as Israel's government presses ahead with new settlements in the occupied West Bank, and attacks by settlers, including arson, shootings, and beatings, have intensified as attention shifts to the Iran war. Israel's settlements in the West Bank considered a violation of international law. Democrats today celebrated the anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, the Obama-era health care law credited with reducing the numbers of uninsured Americans by half, according to an analysis by the University of Minnesota. Also known as Obamacare, the ACA has insured some 54 million Americans since its inception. Yet a new study from the Kaiser Family Foundation finds remaining deep partisan divisions about the Obama-era health care law. 90% of Democrats support the ACA, while 32% of Republicans do, and 64% of independents do. A KFF poll last week shows 80% of ACA enrollees are reporting an increase in health care costs after Republicans refused to extend COVID-era subsidies for the health insurance under the ACA marketplace that expired the first of the year. 51% are reporting a high increase since then. 73% are reporting worries about emergency medical care, and half report they're cutting back on other expenses just to pay for health care insurance. Democrats House Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi and South Bay Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren joined medical professionals and health care advocates to celebrate the anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. They discussed strategies for strengthening ACA against what they say are relentless attacks from the Trump administration and his Republican allies. Max Pringle reports.
Washington, D.C.-based healthcare advocacy group Protect Our Care organized the web event. Protect Our Care says it's a critical time for the ACA, Medicare, and other healthcare services. Protect Our Care held 7 events across the country today. Matt Herdman is director of Protect Our Care California.
The Republican priorities are crystal clear. They're spending $2 billion a day on a foreign war while they cut nearly $1 trillion from Medicaid. It's the largest cuts to our social services in the history of this country. They stand for foreign intervention. They stand for tax cuts for billionaires, but they don't stand for working families that rely on Medicaid, that rely on the ACA tax credits. And simply, that's who they are. And, you know, there's a couple Republicans that came over and did the right thing on the ACA tax credit votes, but not enough. And we're struggling to get things through the Senate.
According to Protect Our Care, healthcare premiums have more than doubled for some 22 million Americans since Republicans did away with the ACA's enhanced premium tax credits last year. That's led to more than 1 million Americans being priced out of coverage. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House has managed to pass a reauthorization of ACA subsidies for 3 years earlier this year, but work remains in the Senate.
We got 17 Republican votes in the House to do that, but we still are not hearing from the Senate. So some of the focus now has to be on the Senate because we sent it over there past the House, and the House is a tough place for children and other living things, but nonetheless, we got 17 votes over there.
President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill cuts more than $1.2 trillion from federal spending, mainly on services like Medicaid and the ACA. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from the South Bay said that her constituents contact her office often and are angry about the cuts.
For a lot of people in their early 60s, they're waiting to get on Medicare. They may not be fully employed. They're in trouble, and they're ticked off. We can find the money to do all this other stuff. To give tax breaks, these billionaire bros who apparently have the ear of the president, to spend $2 billion a day attacking Iran for what reason, but we can't let them get medical care? People are people are unhappy about it, and they're right to be unhappy about it. This was a choice that the president and the Republicans made, and it was a wrong choice.
Protect Our Care says Amazon, for example, paid $9 billion in taxes in 2024, but after the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill last year, their tax bill went down to $1.2 billion. The group says that's a nearly $8 billion giveaway to the ultra-wealthy corporation, while millions of Americans are struggling to pay for health care. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
Armed federal immigration officers in tactical gear moved through terminals at some of the nation's busiest airports today, standing near security lines and checkpoints after President Trump ordered their deployment during a partial shutdown that's disrupted air travel nationwide. The administration says the officers are intended to supplement TSA, Transportation Security Administration, staffing at certain airports, but has provided few details about their exact role. Following intensified immigration enforcement actions and protests in cities across the country over the past year, their presence has unsettled some travelers and raised new questions about the scope of federal authority in airport spaces. Concerns about expanding immigration enforcement at U.S. airports comes as the Department of Homeland Security shutdown stretches past a month, and as videos circulating online appear to show federal agents violently detaining a woman at San Francisco International Airport. The incident, which federal officials described as isolated, is raising fresh scrutiny. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Where's your badge? Can I see? Let me see your badge. Okay. No, can I see your badge? I don't know if that's legitimate.
Reports circulating on social media Sunday evening appeared to show federal agents detaining a woman at San Francisco International Airport. Footage shows officers in plain clothes appearing dressed as casual travelers, holding her down and attempting to handcuff and restrain the crying woman as her young daughter looks on in tears and in distress. Some clips show the woman being pulled to the ground during the arrest. Additional videos portraying multiple angles appear to show members of the San Francisco Police Department attempting to separate onlookers from the scene and act as a buffer as the arrest unfolded. The videos have sparked concern and confusion about whether immigration enforcement operations are expanding at Bay Area airports, following the Trump administration's announcement over the weekend that ICE would be assisting TSA agents during the government shutdown. However, SFO is among the largest airport nationwide that allows private contractors to handle passenger screening under TSA oversight, meaning the impacts of the shutdown have been minimal in the Bay Area. But according to SFO spokesperson Doug Yackel, federal officers were transporting the woman and her young daughter on an outbound flight when the incident occurred. And officials, quote, believe it was an isolated situation, close quote, with no indication of broader enforcement activity at SFO. Airport officials also said they were not notified in advance and were not involved in the incident, adding that airport operations continued normally without disruption. State Senator Scott Wiener, a Democrat from San Francisco and candidate for Congress, held a news conference Monday outside the airport to denounce the actions of federal authorities.
ICE is not welcome in San Francisco or at San Francisco International Airport.
Wiener echoed the statement from airport representatives, saying the incident appeared to be targeted.
That what happened last night was not part of ICE's roving patrol terror campaign that they are doing in other areas, and it appears that it was not part of what they're doing now at other airports by sending ICE agents supposedly to help TSA, but really to inflict terror.
Posting to X, the Department of Homeland Security confirmed that the officers were ICE agents and identified the woman and child as Angelina Lopez Jimenez and Wendy Godinez Lopez. DHS said the family had a final removal order for an immigration judge dating back to 2019. The agency further alleges that while being escorted to the international terminal for processing, Lopez Jimenez attempted to flee and resisted law enforcement officers. However, the state senator says he is not quick to accept the agency's account.
After they declared that Alex Preti was a terrorist, they really have no credibility.
DHS also posted, quote, that ICE is working as quickly as possible to repatriate the family unit to their home country of Guatemala, close quote. But California Congresswoman Doris Matsui, who represents the state capital, described the woman as a neighbor and a member of the community. Posting to social media, Matsui said, quote, I am deeply angered by the video released of a Sacramento mother being forcibly detained by ICE in front of her young daughter, close quote. On social media, the footage also generated concern over the administration's move to place ICE officers at airports, as many Transportation Security Administration officers have reportedly quit or called out sick after weeks of working without pay, and the ongoing DHS shutdown now in its sixth week. ICE officers were reportedly spotted Monday at several airports across the country after Trump said he would deploy them unless Democrats agree to legislation to fund the Department of Homeland Security. Here's the president speaking outside of Air Force One.
I want to thank ICE because they stepped in so strongly. They'll do great. And if that's not enough, I'll bring in the National Guard.
Trump also called for ICE agents to be unmasked at airports, something State Senator Scott Wiener, who has pushed California legislation limiting the use of face coverings by federal agents, took note of.
This morning, Donald Trump admitted that masking is not necessary for ICE to do its job. He said he doesn't want to see ICE wearing masks as they engage in enforcement at airports, but he does want to see them continue to wear masks when they are terrorizing immigrant communities. So Donald Trump said the quiet part out loud.
Notably, Sunday's arrest at SFO occurred before ICE officers were deployed to bolster TSA, raising fresh questions about the limitations of the city's sanctuary policies and so-called ICE-free zones. Online, the San Francisco Police Department has also faced backlash amid public perception that officers were assisting ICE agents during the arrest. KPFA News reached out to the department, who declined a recorded interview, but provided the following statement. Quote, on Sunday, March 22, at approximately 10 p.m., SFPD officers responded to a 911 call at San Francisco International Airport. Officers arrived on scene and determined the incident involved federal immigration officials. SFPD officers were not involved in the incident, but remained on scene to maintain public safety, close quote. But when asked further about communications between the department and how officers were able to confirm the unidentified men in plain clothes were federal agents, SFPD has not returned our additional request for comment. We put the same question to Senator Wiener during the press conference. He said ICE has a record of not identifying its agents, but did not directly condemn the police presence at the scene.
It appears that SFPD were there to maintain order in the airport, and they are always in a very, very difficult position when you have ICE doing the things that it does.
San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie also reiterated on social media that SFPD officers remained on scene for public safety. He called the incident upsetting and said there was no reason to believe there is a broader federal immigration enforcement operation unfolding at SFO. The Oakland International Airport has also confirmed that they have not been advised of any operational changes or planned deployments at this time. But in response to growing concerns about immigration enforcement actions, State Senator Jesse Ottaguin of Oakland has introduced legislation that would require California to track and publicly report ICE activity across the state. He says the SFO incident highlights the need for greater transparency. The measure is scheduled for its first hearing before the Senate Public Safety Committee tomorrow. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Support comes from the UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting the Taishan Sori Trio on April 10th at the Nimoy. The Pulitzer Prize-winning composer joins forces with pianist Aaron Deal and bassist Harish Raghavan in a genre-blurring jazz trio. Celebrated for their bold reinterpretations of original works, the trio delivers emotionally charged performances that reshape the great American songbook. Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hearing last week, Mullen signaled he would pursue operational changes while continuing to carry out the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda.
My goal is for people to understand we're out there, we're protecting them, and we're working with them.
Mullen comes to the position after more than a decade in Congress and with management experience running his family's plumbing business in Oklahoma. Still, he's not been widely viewed as a leading voice on immigration policy. A former mixed martial arts fighter and collegiate wrestler known for organizing early morning workouts for lawmakers, Mullen's built relationships across party lines and is sometimes seen as a negotiator. However, his strong loyalty to President Trump is seen as a key factor in his appointment, and he's not expected to depart significantly from the administration's approach to immigration enforcement. Mullen is the first Native American to serve as Secretary of Homeland Security, the second Native American to hold a position in a executive branch. His first major challenge will be restoring routine funding to the department, which has been blocked since mid-February as Democrats push for tighter limits on immigration enforcement actions. Among their demands, requiring officers to identify themselves and avoid wearing face covers near schools, churches, hospitals, and other body cameras, and requiring judicial warrants before entering private homes. In most circumstances. At his confirmation hearing, Mullen sought to present himself as a steady hand during a turbulent period for the agency, though that characterization was challenged by committee chair Rand Paul during a tense exchange. Democrats have also expressed skepticism, viewing Mullen as a reliable executor of Trump's immigration agenda. Mullen also walked back earlier comments he made about a protester, Alex Preti, who was shot and killed by an ICE officer, saying he would avoid drawing conclusions before investigations are complete. He's indicated he may push for some operational changes as well, including requiring judge-signed warrants for home entries in most cases and acknowledging community concerns about large ICE detention facilities. Mullins also said cutting federal funds to sanctuary jurisdictions would be a last resort. Ultimately, immigration enforcement priorities are set by the White House. Mullen's expected to closely follow President Trump's lead as the administration faces pressure from within the GOP to fulfill its pledge to deport 1 million people a year. You are listening to the Pacifica Evening News from KPFA 94.1 FM, 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, It's an hour-long newscast that airs each night at 6 o'clock with half-hour editions on the weekends. All our newscasts are archived online at kpfa.org and are available as a podcast. I'm Christina Onnestad. States across the country face costs exceeding $1 billion to implement the Trump administration's new Medicaid work requirements, which are set to take effect at the beginning of next year. This, according to an Associated Press analysis of budget projections in more than 25 states. The requirement, part of a tax cut law signed by President Trump, will affect Medicaid enrollees ages 19 through 64 without young children above the typical income eligibility cutoff. Those enrollees must work or perform community service at least 80 hours a month or enroll at least half-time as a student, and will face eligibility reviews every 6 months instead of annually. The Congressional Budget Office projects the provisions will result in 6 million fewer people with health insurance over the next decade. Some Medicaid analysts warn large sums could flow to vendors building complex eligibility systems that may ultimately block eligible people from receiving care. Georgia, the only state currently with a work requirement, spent more than $54 million in administrative costs, twice its medical assistance payouts for Medicaid over the same period. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether states can continue to count mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day, an election issue targeted by President Donald Trump, who wants to curtail voting access and tighten voting requirements. All 50 states require ballots to be cast or postmarked on or before Election Day, but 14 states have grace periods for receiving and counting regular mailed ballots, ranging from a day to several weeks after election. Republicans could have sued in any of those states, including New York, Illinois, or Washington, but they chose Republican Mississippi to put the case in front of the Fifth Circuit, where a panel of three Trump appointees struck down the law. That led to challenges now before the Supreme Court. The premise of the case Watson versus Republican National Committee is that Congress banned post-election day grace periods for processing mail-in ballots in 1845 when it enacted a national election day. Paul Clement, former U.S. Solicitor General under George W. Bush, argued the case for the RNC. In his opening remarks, he said election officials' Herculean efforts to ensure all votes were received by election day during the Civil War proves Congress intended election day as a hard deadline, and to count votes received after the deadline is to go against the law.
All agree that elections for federal office have to end on the day of the election specified by Congress. And all agree that you can't have an election unless you receive ballots, and there must be some deadline for ballot receipt. Nonetheless, Mississippi insists that ballots can trickle in days or even weeks after Election Day. That position is wrong as a matter of text, precedent, history, and common sense.
Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson countered that argument, looking at the historical context, and precedent differently.
This idea of the votes being cast by Election Day and counted after Election Day has been around, right? I mean, it's not like we're talking about a brand new thing from Mississippi from the standpoint of no one ever had a post-election day ballot deadline before.
But conservative justices expressed skepticism over state election laws that allow grace periods. Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch grilled Mississippi State Solicitor General Scott Stewart, who argued on behalf of the state. Justice Samuel Alito questioned whether ballots received after Election Day might undermine public confidence in elections.
And some of the briefs have argued that confidence in election outcomes can be seriously undermined if the apparent outcome of the election on the day after the polls close is radically flipped by the acceptance later of a big stash of ballots that flip the election.
Stewart told the court that despite widespread awareness of and attention to potential election fraud, no fraud has been recorded.
You could have potential fraud. People went across state lines and voted, or you could have the appearance of that sort of fraud, even if it didn't actually happen. Like people just said, oh my gosh, they voted for that person. I'm, you know, big turnout. So I think that's the kind of thing that animated those statutes. Whereas, you know, fraud writ large was not a good example. I do think it's notable that my friends with the United States, obviously they've sounded the anti-fraud theme. They haven't cited a single example of fraud from post-election day ballot receipt in this century.
Clement, who argued for the RNC, also cited a 1997 case, Foster versus Love, in which the court unanimously decided Louisiana's open primary system, where an election could be decided in October ahead of the actual national election day, violated federal statute. Justice Elena Kagan raised concerns that following Foster versus Love's logic, if mail-in voting were to be limited, it would also set the stage for early voting to be eliminated.
It seems to me it's a rule that prevents early voting, because you're basically saying there are two things that have to happen, and they have to happen on election day. And it's the voting and, you know, the casting of the vote and the receipt of the vote. And both of those things have to be on election day. And just like a normal person says, okay, well, when I early vote, I'm not doing that on that first Tuesday.
Justice Kagan also questioned the strength of Clement's reasoning, which was largely based on the decision in Foster v. Love, which said elections must be consummated on election day.
So that's where the theory comes from? It comes from the word that this court used in Foster?
Yes, and that was a word.
I mean,
that
don't look so, you know, because a word that we used in Foster is the premise for your being able to separate Mississippi's law from every early voting law in the world, even though your basic theory should say that the early voting laws are also verboten?
Outside the courthouse, Alaskan election officials say they're monitoring the case. Alaska, with its enormous size and severe winter weather, is one of four Republican-controlled states that counts late-arriving ballots. The state's senior senator, Republican Lisa Murkowski, said there's probably no other state where this ruling could have a more detrimental impact than ours. The high court's decision could also impact rural voters in other states and service members and other Americans living abroad. A final ruling on Watson versus Republican National Committee is expected by late June. Clement says that is early enough to go into effect for the 2026 midterm congressional elections. California's governor's race is heating up with a debate televised on ABC7 and Univision scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday night. That's also sponsored by the University of Southern California. Six gubernatorial candidates will debate on stage, two Republicans, four Democrats. They are Republican Chad Bianco, Riverside County Sheriff, Republican Steve Hilton, a Fox News contributor and former advisor to British Prime Minister David Cameron, Democrat Matt Mahan, San Jose Mayor, Democrat Katie Porter, former Congresswoman for L.A., Democrat Tom Steyer, a billionaire and former presidential candidate, and Democrat Eric Swalwell, an East Bay congressman. All of them are white. Not one candidate of color made the cut for the debate, including Democrats, former Health Secretary Javier Becerra, former Los Angeles Mayor Antonia Villaraigosa, Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond, and former State Controller Betty Yee. They spoke out against the exclusion to the debate in a press briefing Friday.
This process is rigged.
Villaraigosa blasted the formula used to qualify candidates.
It has the effect of denying the four candidates of color in this debate.
And he says the formula used was not applied fairly.
This was supposed to be based on polling and money raised. Some of us have been able to raise more money and are higher in the polls than a candidate who was invited.
Former Health Secretary Bezzetto lamented that gubernatorial candidate San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, who entered the campaign late but has received millions from wealthy tech interests, is being allowed to the debate, noting Mahan has connections to the center where the formula was created to pick the top six candidates.
I don't think anyone has ever used this formula. I've never seen this before. This is a formula that was weighted in favor of the most recent entrant with the most, with the largest number of mega donors. In other words, the less time you spend on the campaign trail and the more you rely on billionaires and mega donors, the more credit you get for eligibility to participate in this campaign.
Bezzetto said in a letter to USC, quote, you disqualified all of the candidates of color from participating while you invited a white candidate who has never polled higher than some of the candidates of color, including me. KPFA reached out to the University of Southern California as well as Mahan's campaign. Jim Key at the University of Southern California Dornsife Office of Communications said the methodology was based on well-established metrics consistent with formulas widely used to set debate participation nationwide, a combination of polling and fundraising, and developed without regard to any particular candidate. He also said no one at USC in the administration or at the Center for Political Future or at ABC or Univision influenced its development or implementation of the methodology. The LA Times is reporting the co-director at the Center for Political Future at the university is supporting Mahan's campaign, but said he recused himself from anything involved in the debate. Still, the candidates of color say the optics aren't looking good. Here's Superintendent of Instruction Tony Thurmond and former state controller Betty Yee.
I am the only Afro-Latino on the ballot. To say that I don't have a place here because someone has raised more money, what message does that send?
Voters will not have the opportunity to really hear from all of the candidates and to be able to make an informed, discerned decision.
The exclusion of all Democratic candidates of color comes after Rusty Hicks, head of the Democratic Party in California, called on the low polling candidates to drop out of the governor's race, warning they could dilute the Democratic vote and cause two Republicans to make it to the November ballot this June. California's governor system allows the top two vote getters to advance to the November election, regardless of party affiliation. The candidates who spoke out Friday dispute those claims. Chad Bianco, the GOP Riverside County Sheriff who's running for California governor, seized 650,000 ballots cast in last November's special election from county officials, saying he's investigating a claim of voter fraud. County election officials dispute the claims he made. Those were claims repeated by the Riverside Election Integrity Team, which reported the claims to Bianco. The group alleges there were some 45,000 more votes tallied than ballots received and logged by the Riverside County Registrar of Voters. Bianco, a Trump supporter, announced the investigation Friday.
Our investigation will determine the validity of that alleged discrepancy, and if found true, we will determine the cause. We will do that by physically counting the ballots. This is not a recount to determine how many votes were for or against Prop 50.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta called Bianco's move unprecedented and says it's designed to sow distrust in elections. Bianco, during his press briefing, cited lower confidence in elections.
A recent study by UC San Diego revealed that 40% of Californians do not trust our election process or our counting mechanism. This is alarming. The purpose of any investigation is to determine the merits of allegations. It is basically a fact-finding mission. This investigation is simple. Physically count the ballots and compare that result with the total votes reported.
Wanda has repeatedly sent letters to Bianco's office over the last 2 months, also saying Bianco's staff is not qualified to conduct a recount. In one of the letters, Bonta wrote the ballot seizure was unacceptable and sets a dangerous precedent. The letter said Bianco seized nearly 1,000 boxes of ballots and elections material from the county's elections office with a warrant in February. Bianco said the alleged discrepancy amounted to a 45,800 votes, a difference elections officials have refuted at county meetings, saying the machine count and the final vote count submitted to the state differed by about 100 votes. Bianco says he's been investigating claims of voter fraud since 2022 and admitted Friday he hasn't found any.
We have not found any mass fraud in Riverside County in elections. But as part of this,
in November, the special election voters approved Proposition 1 last year to redraw congressional district lines to favor Democrats in the upcoming midterms. The measure passed in Riverside County by a margin of more than 80,000 votes. Bianco sees ballots in Riverside County, where is the home of 2.5 million people, where he has twice been elected sheriff. He called the effort a fact-finding mission and said the investigation had absolutely nothing to do with his campaign for governor. The effort comes as President Trump has repeatedly disputed the results of the 2020 election, citing unsubstantiated instances of voter fraud. His administration recently seized ballots and other documents from elections office in Georgia. Some Republicans have mirrored Trump's rhetoric on voting in their states. Bianco said Friday a judge has appointed a special master to oversee his investigation's vote count. An Air Canada jet carrying more than 70 passengers collided with a fire truck while landing at New York's LaGuardia Airport, killing two pilots and injuring several others. Officials say the fire truck was crossing the tarmac late Sunday after being given permission to check on another plane reporting an odor aboard. Before the collision, an air traffic controller could be heard on airport communications frantically telling the fire truck to stop. The crash temporarily shut down LaGuardia, the New York region's third busiest hub, during what was already a messy time at U.S. airports. The runway where the crash happened is likely to be closed for days during the investigation, according to NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy. She spoke at an evening news conference and said there's a tremendous amount of debris that investigators still have to sift through. Homendy said authorities recovered the plane's cockpit and flight data recorders and drove them to the agency's lab in Washington for analysis. Officials had to cut a hole in the aircraft's roof to access the recorders because its tail was on the ground. She said, adding the cockpit voice recorder undamaged. Homendy said it was too early in the investigation to answer questions about the incident. It's the latest in a series of airline crashes and accidents under President Donald Trump's term in office, including a January collision in 2025 last year near the Ronald Reagan Airport, in which 67 people were killed. The crash at LaGuardia shut down the plane until today. More than 400 flights were canceled, and TSB now saying the closure could be multiple more days. California lawmakers received free overseas trips, airfare, tickets to sporting events, clothes, and other gifts worth more than $1 million from special interests last year, according to a report from CalMatters. Among the bought and paid for gifts, a golf tournament at the scenic Pebble Beach Golf Links with free spa treatments, a 6-day stay at an upscale resort in Maui, tours to Spain, Portugal, Norway, and Australia. Nearly 120 organizations, including nonprofits, corporations, foreign governments, state agencies, tribes, and campaigns, spent at least $1.2 million on travel for legislators last year, according to the legislators' annual financial disclosures filed earlier this month. Lawmakers also received more than $330,000 in gifts last year, including dinners at Michelin-guided restaurants, suite tickets to Warriors, Kings, and athletic games, tickets to Disneyland, and free massages, some of them from the same groups that sponsored the trips. 59 lawmakers reported receiving tickets to sporting events, concerts, award ceremonies, fine dining experiences, or theme parks, according to the analysis. The bulk of the tab, $1.1 million, was picked up by nonprofits that are largely allowed to keep their donors secret, leaving the true source of the funding murky. The entities, many of which represent major corporations and interest groups, are only required to reveal their donors if they hit certain spending thresholds, which are so high that they are rarely required to disclose them. State officials can generally accept unlimited travel sponsored by nonprofits as long as the trips are for governmental or policy reasons. But ethics advocates say the practice of sponsored travel allows interest groups to buy private access to policymakers they want to influence, the kind of access out of reach for average California voters. A new bill would tighten regulations of nonprofit spending on lawmakers and make it easier to require disclosures of that spending. Democrat Tasha Borner of San Diego has introduced Assembly Bill 1788. It's backed by the Fair Political Practices Commission, which enforces campaign finance and ethic laws. Lawmakers have introduced a new bipartisan bill at the nation's capital to lower student loans. It would lower interest rates on student loans to 2%. They currently range from 6% to nearly 9%, depending on the borrower and the loan type. It would also apply retroactively. California Representative Mike Thompson, a Democrat of Napa County and parts of Contra Costa, Lake Solano, and Yolo counties, is a sponsor. He says the bill addresses the cost of education and a worker shortage across the country. Average tuition for both public and private four-year colleges has doubled over the last 30 years, faster than the cost of inflation, according to Education Data Initiative. High tuition costs, he says, bar many young people from receiving a post-secondary education.
Today, 85% of adults who drop out of school or choose not to pursue higher education at all said that the cost of education was their main reason.
Georgetown Center on Education and Workforce reports skilled baby boomers are exiting the workforce in increasing numbers and leaving behind more positions than there are highly educated young people to fill. The nation will need an additional 5 million workers with post-secondary education through the year 2032.
We have a shortage of doctors, a shortage of nurses, a shortage in the trades, and a shortage of teachers. These are all critical spots that need to be filled for the future of our country. And making student loans more affordable is a big step in that direction.
Co-leading the bill with Thompson is Guam Representative James Moylan, a Republican. He says the importance of legislation to territories, including his native Guam.
It's most important for our territories as well, where we struggle with high cost of getting our education in the mainland, especially the traveling cost just to get there back and forth as well.
Minority and underrepresented populations are steadily growing but often lack access to higher education as a result of financial institutional barriers, according to the Center on Education and Workforce. Access to training and education among these groups, they say, is the most direct way to address worker shortages. Until recently, students from the territories had to pay out-of-state tuition, often 2 to 3 times the state rates. Recent legislation by Moylan gave students in U.S. territories access to reduced in-state prices. He said working alongside Thompson on the new bill would tie in well with his previous work. California Assemblymember James Ramos, a Democrat, wants to make Native American Day a paid holiday for California state employees. It's currently a federal holiday that is recognized but not compensated. He's introduced Assembly Bill 1841 to do that, spoke in support of it at an event at the state capitol.
And we start to look at the reasonings why there should be a paid holiday for California's First People. We see the history of the state of California towards California's First People, the atrocities, the mission system, the gold rush years that took land from our people, and still the resiliency of our people to stand here and talk in our language and sing our traditional songs.
Really?
But also for the ancestors that continue to cry out in the grounds, even the grounds that we're on. It's time that the voices continue to move forward and to make sure that we're calling out for respect and honor for California's First People.
Support comes from the Alex Theater, presenting the Ravi Shankar Ensemble on March 31st at 8 p.m. Curated by Anushka and Sukanya Shankar, this debut U.S. tour celebrates the legendary Ravi Shankar's music with rare archival visuals and live performance featuring sitar, tabla, and other traditional Indian classical instruments. This will be a very special evening honoring Ravi Shankar's enduring legacy. More information and tickets are available at itsmyseat.com and kpfk.org.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent